Hey everybody, have you ever stopped to think about at a time of crisis in the community and the country, the men and women who are on the front line and how they serve while everyone else is taking cover from the storm or glued to their TVs watching some national event unfold? My guest today was one of those men on the front line on January 6th. And he has a story to tell about that experience. Michael Fanone served as a Metropolitan Police Department officer assigned to the First District for 20 years. When he self-deployed to the Capitol on January 6, 2021, he had no idea how his life was about to change. Politicians, friends, and even his fellow officers criticized his decision to become outspoken about the insurrection on January 6th. And now he has taking that to the point where he wants you really to shake you by the collar to understand exactly what happened. He has a new book, Hold the Line: The Insurrection and One Cop's Battle for America's Soul, where he's calling us to action if we want to preserve this democracy. We're going to talk to Michael, talk about his experience, and talk about what we as citizens need to understand about what really happened on January 6th, right after this. Well, everybody, like I said, for me, this is kind of a special moment to have someone like Officer Fanone to come on the podcast. You know, we do a lot of politicians, we do a lot of folks out there who are dealing with other aspects of our culture, but rarely do we get a chance to talk to someone who's on the front line for us every day and have been a force that's been a silent but important force to hold us all together and to keep us safe. And January 6th was a real stress test for that moment. And so, Officer Fanone, Michael Fanone, it's just a real pleasure, man, to have you on the podcast.
Well, likewise, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
And I tell you, as a DC boy, as a DC native, I always appreciate one of our own. So it's I thank you in a particular way for your service to the city. And I know be even before January 6th, that was a stress test in and of itself, dealing with the crazy that comes through Washington, D.C. on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I mean, like we were talking about just before we got started, I think that, fortunately, or I don't know, unfortunately, my law enforcement career uniquely prepared me for dealing with members of Congress.
Right. So well put. So well put. Yeah, I'm sure it did. Look, I tell people all the time, having grown up in Washington, I grew up in the Petworth neighborhood. My parents are still there, and I'm back there rather frequently. And yeah, the city's changing and all of that. But one of the biggest changes for someone like myself has been watching the men and women who come to town to serve on Capitol Hill, either as a member, a senator, staffer. And the quality and character of those people have changed tremendously. And it's all about the me, myself, and I. It's not about the service. It's not about the level of commitment. And unfortunately, after January 6th, we really got to see that underbelly, that other side, as members returned to the House to vote to overturn the election. The lack of respect given to the men and women in uniform who served heroically that day. You lost friends. You saw your fellow officers injured, and the lack of sensitivity to that, to me, and I think for a lot of Washingtonians, was very telling. Your book is entitled Hold the Line, and that's what you were trained to do. That's what you innately know to do in circumstances like that. You're not looking for reward or a pat on the back. But what made January 6th and the response to it by those you protected different for you?
Well, you talked about my law enforcement career. I think a lot of people forget that I was a cop for 20 years before January 6th and with the Metropolitan Police Department. I worked primarily in narcotics, dealt with violent criminals on a daily basis. And, it would be a mistake to say that January 6th was the only critical incident that I was ever involved in. But it certainly was the only critical incident where, in the immediate aftermath, I was told that it wasn't as significant as what I know that I experienced, or that it just didn't happen at all. And then to find myself, vilified for speaking the truth about what happened that day, just talking about the reality of the violence, the fact that, some of these insurrectionists were armed, what their intentions were, and who the makeup of the offenders really was. It was not Antifa. It was not some, FBI orchestrated event. It was Trump supporters who were unhappy with the results of an election, who stormed the Capitol in an attempt to prevent Congress from certifying the election.
It's interesting you say that, and sort of point to that service, how that service is viewed by others, maybe even the lack of appreciation for that service prior to January 6th, and how all of that really kind of played into how you responded on that day and the role that you played. You note in the book, you say, quote, "It gnawed at me that people I could not control were twisting my words to suit their agenda." As this narrative around January 6th was beginning to unfold, journalists are asking you a lot of questions about it, wanting to get your reactions. You said, "A growing false narrative portrayed me as a darling of the left. I worried that I was being used by both sides. So did some of my closest friends. Online, people seemed to be turning me into a cartoon I didn't recognize. I had a singular mission: respect for officers who responded to defend the Capitol on January 6th, and accountability for those responsible for and those involved in the insurrection." Period. That in reading the book and going through it, that's one of the interesting aspects of this that I found really telling, is that while all of this is going on, you stayed and really tried to draw people back to that last point. This is about what happened to me and the officers in that involved that day. It was about looking at folks who should be held accountable and asking that they be held accountable. There's no agenda here. There's no, right or left. I'm a police officer. I have to serve and protect everybody. How do you work through that? And how did you work through that to get to that point to just sort of, almost scream it throughout the book? This is what we're about here, people. Do you have to understand what happened here?
Well, that was one of the reasons that I even got involved in that project at all was when I took the job with CNN, a lot of it was born out of necessity. I needed a job, and they offered me a job, and so there was that factor. But it was also, I was hoping to be part of a conversation on a major cable news network, talking about some of these issues. What I found difficult is that, the time allotted doesn't always allow you to address them
You
completely.
got 6 minutes, baby.
Right. I mean, that's being generous. And so, I figured, well, if I want to get all my thoughts out, I might as well get involved in some project that has a format that would allow me to do so. And so in the book, I try to talk about those issues at length, but my motivation has always been singular in that I'm looking for acknowledgement for these officers that fought specifically in the West Terrace.
Right.
But any of the officers that responded and fought that day to, you know, preserve our democracy and fought to, you know, prevent the injury or death of members of Congress.
So you note in the book that you were, you just referenced being at an analyst for CNN, my old MSNBC coming out there. But you know that you were, quote, an aggressive CNN hater. and here you are on this platform. What was it? And not so much about CNN, but what did you see about how these platforms functioned, the role that they play or can play in some of these national narratives, especially? So as an example, I note back in 2016, even after that, you know, everybody bitching about Donald Trump and the Republican Party, but specifically about Trump and Trumpism. And I think back, you know, the people I know in media across the spectrum from Fox to CNN, including my own backyard of MSNBC, there were people who helped facilitate a lot of that, you know, because Donald Trump was great clickbait. And now, having contributed a part to the creation of the Frankenstein monster, you know, they're hoping the villagers take him down and, you know, kill the thing. I see similar examples now with the January 6th story in how that's covered and how these platforms talk about it. Coming in from your work in policing to now being on these platforms in this space, how do you see that? I mean, what kind of perspectives do you take away from what you're seeing on that? It's on that side of it now, sitting on the other side, opposite side of the camera versus having the microphones in front of you saying, Officer Fanon, what happened here?
First of all, I mean, despite being employed by a major cable news network, I'm not a supporter of cable news.
Right.
My suggestion would be you turn it off and go outside and do something. That being said, you know, that it's a major source of, you know, people's consumption of news. I look at it, you know, from my perspective, I didn't really get involved in hating CNN or MSNBC until 2015, which is about the same time that I started to support Donald Trump. You know, I was a one-issue voter. My issue was law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
What I saw in these news networks and also in liberal or progressive politicians, the Democratic Party, I saw an attack on police officers. And that was real. And and the results of that were real. You know, we saw an unprecedented amount of ambush style or essentially assassinations of police officers in the, you know, months and years following Michael Brown and Ferguson.
Right.
We saw riots. We saw injuries to officers, injuries to civilians, businesses destroyed. And yeah, I think it's a two-part issue. It's the way that liberal news or liberal-leaning media organizations carried those stories,
right,
in a way that the more conservative news outlets like Fox News portrayed them. There was an overemphasis on the right as to, you know, law enforcement being under attack. And then there was an underemphasis or even a justification for that popping up in
on the left,
liberal news organizations. But what was being ignored by both was what the effect on the average street cop was. And I saw it every single day.
Mm-hmm.
I saw officers just taking a lunch break, being yelled at, spit on, having people spit in their meal, refusing to serve them. I mean, those were real things that happened on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, I saw it play out, and it took its toll on cops.
You talk extensively about that in the book, under the chapter Black Lives Matter. How do officers sort of work through the reaction of communities to events that occur, their reaction to how the police respond to those events, whether it's a traffic stop gone bad, whether it's a domestic violence call that, you know, winds up with an officer being shot or killed. So you have those, almost like you guys are caught in these two worlds, both dangerous for a lot of the same, but also different reasons. You know, a domestic call is not the same as a traffic stop per se, that may go sideways that leads to the death of a citizen versus the death of an officer in another situation. How do you guys process that? Help people kind of understand what that is day in and day out, and what that means and how it's affected policing.
Well, first, I mean, I can really only speak for my department, for the Metropolitan Police Department, because
right.
that's all that I was ever exposed to. Although I've engaged in conversations with officers all over the country, and the experience seems to be the same. Let me, you know, first dismiss the idea of this, you know, thin blue line of silence.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to, as if there's some unified response that anytime a police officer acts and it becomes major news that everyone in that department supports the officer.
Right.
That's not true. You know, our responses are the same. I always say that, you know, police departments are a microcosm of society. So our reactions vary just like the reactions of the public vary. Some police officers are inherently supportive pretty much no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
They've engaged in this kind of us against them mentality. And then there's other police officers that are incredibly critical of, you know, officers. There's people that question officers' motivations. There are, you know, it's very diverse in the way that police officers react to their own when it comes to those types of incidents. And police officers are probably the most critical when it comes to critiquing their own in the aftermath of these events. I mean, you know, there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking that goes on within the police department.
Well, that makes sense on a number of levels, because you guys are obviously more familiar with the procedures and the protocols, and you know when someone has stepped outside that line. And you also know that when that happens, there is a ripple effect, both internally and externally.
Oh, absolutely.
Your chain of command is like, okay, time out. Let's get there. And then the public is like, whoa, 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 what the hell is happening here? So there is, I think, probably a greater discipline among officers. What oftentimes gets pointed up, though, and again, it goes to how we narratively engage around these circumstances, is, and what perpetuates this notion of the thin blue line or the blue wall of silence or and all of that, is in order to get to the truth and understand what happened, there's a procedure and a process internally that's got to be followed. You cannot just throw those officers to the wolves per se, but you also can't come off as protecting them and saving them from their own actions. And so that's what makes this very, very difficult, which is why what we saw play out on January 6th was ironic in many respects, because here you had the officers doing what they were told to do, trained to do, expected to do. And yet that was the reaction by the Law and Order Party, my party, to that was anything but supportive of you, of officers like you. And it kind of turned the whole narrative on its head in many respects. And it showed to me that the one thing we cannot allow to happen very much writ large with the democracy, but specifically with policing in these situations, is allow the politics to drive the story, to allow the politics to infect the narrative in a way that exposes officers and policing unfairly. So suddenly those who were supporting the blue, Blue Lives Matter were trashing those very same blue lives. They were hitting them with flagpoles. They were trying to get their guns to kill them. We know what happened to you in trying to defend your position. How do officers now look at all of this? When you guys, you've since retired from the force, but you still have friends there, the next big demonstration, the next national event, how do you think what are they thinking, do you think? Or what would you be thinking if you're now put in that situation and you're like, well, who's got my back out here?
I mean, within the Metropolitan Police Department, I could tell you that it was already, like, we already felt as though we had been in a lot of ways abandoned by local politicians, mm-hmm. City council and the mayor's office. What I think it just contributed to, an even more cynical, approach to politicians and to the community at large, as though, nobody gives a shit.
Mm-hmm.
We had already been abandoned by, or had this perception of being abandoned by the Democratic Party. Now we've been abandoned by the Republican Party. What are we fucking doing this for?
Right. So on that point, how would you describe your relationship with the party prior to the, you gave the indication a little bit earlier that, you obviously supportive of your fellow officers, Republicans at least articulated a support for those officers. So I assume that there was some alliance there, if not necessarily being registered Republican, but, you felt that at least politically and otherwise your back would be covered. That clearly is not the case. So how do you now look at the political parties? Because the one thing I appreciate about you, and people who know me know I appreciate this because it's how I roll, is that you basically don't give a shit. I'm going to tell you what I think and what I feel. And you can go off and process that however you want to do it. But this is where I stand. And I think a lot of people were rather surprised by your very straightforward narrative tone, statements about what you saw and what had happened to you in the response by the politicians involved.
Yeah, I mean, first, I believe in a two-party system. And I just don't believe that as a voter, not a politician, not somebody who works for any political apparatus, I'm not going to affiliate myself with one party or the other.
And right. I think
we as Americans have just become politically lazy in that we, blindly cast ballots for either red or blue.
Right.
Rather than, you know, looking at the character of the candidate, looking at, you know, the different issues that he or she may be supportive of or against. And then, you know, I also think that there's an issue with looking at the candidate as to, you know, would that person also, in addition to representing me as an individual, you know, representing my community, and understanding that your community may be made up of people that don't see eye to eye with you. You know, we get a lot of people that are just like, well, vote for me, get me elected, and F everyone else that didn't. I'm only going to support and, you know, protect the people that supported me. I'm, you know, I very much take politics a la carte. I have certain issues that are most important to me and,
right.
and the candidates that I'm going to seek out. Now, that being said, you know, not to knock Republicans, but Donald Trump incited a an insurrection.
Right.
And he was involved and his administration was involved in the planning and plotting of a coup, essentially. And so I don't know if at the national level, considering the fact that the Republican Party did not take that being January 6th as an off ramp to, you know, Donald Trump. I don't believe that they are fit to lead at the national level. And until they're able to, you know, rid themselves of that, the Trump stink, I don't see myself supporting Republicans at a national level. You know, on a local level, it's different as long as they're not espousing things like Doug Mastriano or, you know, some of these other candidates who not only support, you know, the false narrative around the 2020 election, but may have actually, you know, organized transportation to an insurrection. I mean, it's incredible to me.
And then they act like they did nothing. I mean, they act like it was nothing to do what they did. How do you assess, because the politicians are one thing. I mean, I've dealt with them. I've been one. Some would say I still am one. I got that. And we are some messed up individuals by and large. I mean, we know that. But what I've always found up throughout our history, the people oftentimes became the stabilizing force, right? They were the ones who would self-correct within the system. They vote people out. They try to put a better generation of people in. All of that now seems to have gone away, and there's less, I put less stress on the politicians and more on the people, because we are where we are, because this is where people largely want us to be. You know, all of this changes tomorrow, certainly will change in November, Michael, if folks say, you know what, I'm not voting for an insurrectionist. I'm not voting for someone. I don't give a shit what inflation is. I don't give a damn about the price of gas. I care more about where the country's headed, because without the underpinnings of democracy, it doesn't matter what the price of gas is, because you can't vote. You can't fully participate. You've got, you know, some asshole dictator, you know, controlling our police and our FBI. And they're now using the law against us. So all these other things begin to matter more to me at the end of the day. What struck me about you from watching you before and then from the very first time I was in the room with you was that urgency. There was this sense of urgency that I get from you about this moment. And it comes through in the book. I think it's, you know, why it's, you titled this Hold the Line. Not just because that's what cops do, not because there's the image of trying to do that on January 6th, physically, literally, but there's also a metaphorical philosophical holding the line. Can you talk a little bit about that? Or maybe I'm just misreading you, in which case tell me, dude, you have no idea what you're talking about. But I just have this sense, and I want to get to it in a little bit more, sort of the personal seriousness that I vibe I get from you. But starting on that level of this idea of the urgency of this moment, of why the voters need to really think about how they're holding the line here.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with your assessment of me. I do see the urgency of this moment, and it is, it's at this point, it's become my life's work. It's what I'm focused on every day when I wake up, and it's what I'm thinking about when I go to sleep. And that's, educating people on the significance of January 6th, which, you know, unfortunately, if you live outside the Beltway, a combination of, right-leaning media and politicians have done a great job of, downplaying what happened, and even, vilifying members of my department or my former department and the U.S. Capitol Police as being like, left-leaning,
right,
activist cops, which is just bullshit.
Right.
That being said, we had a president of the United States in Donald Trump who refused to accept the results of a free and fair election, and with members of his administration, and also, cooperation from some pretty scary groups like Three Percenters, Oath Keepers, and the Proud Boys. And make no mistake about it, these groups are anti-government. They're not concerned about the democratic process,
right,
and they certainly don't care about the republic.
No.
And in a lot of ways, they are, they're just a reimagination or a revamping of, it's like the Klan 2.0. And that, that goes into, when you look at Donald Trump's base, at least for me, in my, layman's observation, I see a lot of people who support Donald Trump at this stage, not necessarily, prior to January 6th or even in the immediate aftermath. But here we are 19 months after. If you're still holding on to the Donald Trump banner, it's either because you're racist, or it's because you enjoy the fact that you have a leader that will essentially not admit to losing. You want to win at all costs.
Right.
You're willing to sacrifice the Constitution, democracy. You're willing to not to acknowledge your fellow Americans and their vote. You just want to win.
Right. That's it. Bottom line. And we see that. We see that now. I was on Morning Joe this morning. We were talking about the Herschel Walker narrative, which completely is one of the craziest things in politics right now. This guy, his former girlfriend said, "Hey, dude, you paid for that abortion, remember?" that I had back in 2009. Here are the receipts. And he's like, "It never happened. I never did that. It's a lie." And then the Republicans just kind of standing, because they want that Senate seat so bad, they're willing to jettison everything else. They're willing to jettison their pro-life, evangelical Christian, demagoguery, because they can't afford to lose that Senate seat. And so you make such an excellent point there, because we see this storyline playing itself out in so many other ways. But I want to dig a little bit further with you, because we were talking about the police and we're talking about this idea of holding the line. Given your inside view, and it may not be as necessarily the case with the Metropolitan Police, but we do know now of stories that have told us about police officers who are part of this right-wing sort of, Three Percenter, Oath Keeper narrative as well. How bothersome is that? How do officers police that, if you will, internally. Because if you've got these folks, I mean, we got, and it's not just police, it's military. I mean, they're, you know, we have some currently serving members of the armed forces who are now caught up in the January 6th cases and are themselves, facing prosecution. How do we as citizens, and how do you as officers, address and deal with those officers, those men and women in uniform, military uniform, who subscribe to these perspectives and these points of view, as you put it, I think rightly, either because they're racist and anti-democratic, or they just want to win at all costs, and so they're comfortable wearing their uniforms, you know, in the daylight, but then at night, being a part of groups that are plotting insurrection.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated, but I actually think that there's, there is a pretty clear and simple answer to that. All of these organizations, whether it's the military or law enforcement in general, like I said before, are a microcosm of society.
Mm-hmm.
So are there going to be racist members of the police department? Yes. Are there going to be racist members of our military? Yes. Are there going to be members of the military that, you know, engage in count themselves in the ranks of some of these anti-government organizations? Absolutely. But again, this is America, and we do enjoy quite a few freedoms that would prevent, you know, the government from kind of, you know, searching and weeding these behaviors out. For me, in the police department, you know, you deal with this in the same way that you deal with officers who, you know, show a propensity for being too violent or heavy.
Right. Because they eventually will out themselves, right? I mean, just by their behavior.
What you need to have is clear, concise, defined standards of conduct, whether it's in the military or whether it is in law enforcement, and hold people to those clear, defined standards.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, the reality is, like, there are cops out there that hate Black people.
Right.
It's like there are cops out there that hate white people.
Mm-hmm.
Or Hispanic people or Asian people. But if, you know, while that is, you know, a horrible thing to think, if they are forced to treat people with respect and can do so, then, you know, as far as we're, you know, unfortunately, that's the best that we're going to get at this stage in the game. And hopefully over time, we're able to, you know, rid our society of those types of beliefs.
Right.
But yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think that's the part that's requires the work, particularly at this time, again, holding that line, setting that standard, being accountable for the kind of people who are coming into these units. And then the level of oversight necessary, as you rightly noted, not to the point of, encroaching on their rights, their constitutional rights, but also trying to at the same time uphold those rights of others by identifying and dealing with them real time, and it is an ongoing struggle and challenge, and the politics, you know, ranges from what we've seen, you know, Blue Lives Matters to Black Lives Matters to defund the police to defund the FBI. You know,
right.
Both sides are engaging in this, but it does require good officers, good systems that will, you know, in the main, hold that line, protect the citizens, respect those rights, but prevent the corrosion from occurring. And that's hard. I mean, it's just hard work. And I think there's a lot from January 6th that exposes that. for us, and that we now may have this sort of 1950s idyllic view of what America is, and, you know, white picket fences and all this other crap. You and I know that's not the case. You served 20 years in narcotics. You were on the streets of DC. You know what Southeast looks like. You also know what Ward 1 in Georgetown looks like, right? So all the pretenses of, well, this is a nice little community over here, baby. No, go into that kitchen to see the cocaine lines on that marble kitchen table top. Right. You don't have to go to the crack house to get a sense of it. So the truth is truth, and how we expose ourselves to that is what guys like you committed to do when you signed up 20 years ago, when you walked onto those Capitol steps on January 6th, it was the same level of commitment. Going to take a quick break. When we come back with Michael, we want to get a little bit more personal, because there's a feature of Michael that I have an enormous amount of respect for. I want to get into that a little bit. So Michael Fanone, the book is Hold the Line. We'll be right back after this.
Retaliation with Julie Roginski is a weekly podcast focused on the stories of women who have spoken truth to power and have persevered despite the costs. It shares the experiences of courageous people who have sometimes been celebrated, but too often castigated for standing up for themselves and for others. Each week, I examine the structures, systems, and culprits responsible for perpetuating and promoting workplace toxicity. You'll hear stories from female celebrities, music label executives, politicians, police officers, and many others as we examine the cultural reevaluations, policy changes, and legal steps that can finally bring an end to the ongoing attack on women in this country and around the world. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. As I said from the beginning, I was looking forward to this conversation with Michael Fanone, former Metropolitan Police Department officer, signed to the First District for 20 years. Michael, one of the things that I tend to be a student of people, so I kind of watch. I step back and I watch people. We did an event a few months ago, and You were in the room with a number of your other officers who were on the Hill on January 6th. And I just kind of watched you, and I watched people react to you. And your demeanor struck me as a little bit uncomfortable, right? It was like, okay, who are these people and why are they shaking my hand? And I get that, because you're police officers, you know, I did what I need to do. That I watched you talk to some people, and it was like you had this like little bullshit meter going off, right? In your eyes, which I thought was fascinating. And then I just got this sense that despite everything else, there's still a lot of frustration and pain that you feel about this on any number of levels, that there's all this noise around January 6th, and there's all this, you know, wanting to touch the officers who were there and thank them and praise them. But I got a sense, at least, that you sensed that people were still kind of missing the point. They were missing the point that your four daughters were first and foremost on your mind as these thugs were reaching for your gun to kill you. Your family, your sense of service was challenged and put at risk. And I just certainly going through the book, this sense that people keep kind of blowing past that part of it, and not really understanding what that was like for you. And some of it came out in your conversation with Molly Ball that you had with her. when she was going to write this piece about you. And it was like, and she's sometimes, you know, she was like asking the question, what if we're too busy arguing about all these other things to face actually what happened that day? And it wasn't just so much what happened on the Hill steps, but what that meant, you know, for your family, your daughters who are learning that their dad had come, had been injured and hurt. How do you process that part of this January 6th story?
I mean, for me, I guess it's multifaceted. I have, you know, my personal experiences on January 6th. And then I have, you know, the experiences that, you know, they're personal in my, you know, advocacy for acknowledgement of officers or just advocacy for accepting what happened on January.
Right, right.
Which is like,
can we all agree that this happened the way it happened, right?
Right. And it's like, that's what the public gets to see is, you know, me calling out Andrew Clyde or Marjorie Taylor Greene or, you know, any of the other deniers of reality. But then I guess in doing that, I haven't really done a lot of focusing on me.
Mm-hmm.
And I also carry with me, you know, there's a lot of other police officers who are struggling a great deal with making sense of what happened to them on January 6th, haven't been acknowledged, who are suffering really silently with, you know, making sense of what happened to them on January 6th. And then the reaction that they've gotten from, you know, national politicians and also from, you know, people outside of the, you know, DC, Maryland, Virginia community, you know, that outside the Beltway crowd that, you know, in a lot of cases may not know the severity of the day because they haven't been told the truth.
Right.
And then some who are just, you know, indifferent. Indifferent because they're police officers, or indifferent because they've got other things that are more important, like inflation and, you know, gas prices and things like that. And that's a tough pill to swallow for those guys.
How's this process gone for your family and your friends? And people who know you and have known you for a long time, and sort of, you know, watch not just what happened that day, but subsequently your own personal journey in sort of grappling with and coming to terms with what happened.
Well, I mean, I think both of my parents have and my immediate family have had similar experiences to what many Americans have experienced under the last 4 or 5 years. And that's, you know, deep divisions, even within their own, you know, immediate group of friends and
right.
family. I mean, I've had members of my family who have distanced themselves because they continue to support Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Who believe that January 6th was some false flag operation orchestrated by the left. You know, my mother is a devout Catholic, and she's had members of her church community turn their backs on her, even voice outrage at the fact that, you know, I'm out here talking about Donald Trump in a certain way.
Right.
I mean, it's, you know, it's varied significantly. There's people that have been incredibly supportive of me, and of my family. And then there have been people who have, turned their backs.
And that's, again, and I think we've all kind of had that experience. I you know, the tragedy of Thanksgiving, where you've got people who don't want to spend time at Thanksgiving with each other because, oh my God, my crazy uncle's going to start talking about Donald Trump, or geez, you know, mom and dad are going to be going off about Joe Biden. It does say a lot about where our politics, being the tail on the dog, is starting to wag the dog. You know, it's starting to dictate the terms of how we engage. And it makes a lot of the elements of this democracy tougher to hold together, because it's like a chisel. You're just chiseling away at various parts of it, and you all ultimately weaken the structure. How is this played out for the response you see from the January 6th Commission? What's your assessment of their work? I think the country was riveted by your testimony and the testimony of your fellow officers that when you appeared. Do you think that that's helped, maybe too strong a word, but it at least began to open up the conversation a bit, turned on a few more light bulbs for people? Or are they just still shutting down the lights and trying to get out of that room because they don't want to know what you know happened, because it happened to you?
Well, I'll say this. I think that, unfortunately, most of the people that paid attention to those hearings and accepted them even as being remotely accurate, mm-hmm. probably not the people that we needed to convince of the reality of January 6th. I mean, for me, it was compelling seeing how, you know, well-planned that day really was. I mean, I had, you know, my, I guess, thoughts going into it as to, you know, planning and preparation, but to right. see it laid out for me was pretty significant. I am kind of disheartened to see that a lot of people that I know who, you know, align themselves with the Republican Party have said, well, you know, it was an atrocity and it was outrageous, but I would still support a Republican candidate, even if they are an election denier, mm-hmm. over Joe Biden or any Democrat. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess that's, to me, it's scary because you've got a lot of people that are, you know, have become so entrenched in their political ideology that right. they would set aside their loyalty or fealty to this country.
How do you, when people sit down, they settle down and start reading Hold the Line, and they sort of walk through with you your own personal journey in all of this, how do you want them to walk away from reading the book and that experience that you share with them? You note in the article that you did with Molly Ball, and I think it's a true element of the book. You say, you know, I wasn't a good cop, I wasn't a bad cop, I was every cop. You know, I'm just a guy who decided to do public service as a career, and I chose this line, and I committed hard to it every day. And yeah, there are problems and there are troubles internally, externally. But I knew what my responsibilities were. So you have that sense of that. But then you have this other thing that happens that's bigger than life, that is a story beyond any story we've seen in American history, short of the Civil War itself. How do you want people to process what they hear from you and read from you in your book?
Well, there's two main themes to the book. One of them obviously is January 6th and my experiences surrounding the events of that day. I want people to look at it in the same way that I thought about getting involved, which was, you know, I don't have a dog in this fight politically.
Right.
I don't care which party wins. I just don't want people who lie and engage in sedition being a part of our elected leadership.
Right.
So, you know, there's that. My experiences that day were real. They were documented. There's body-worn camera footage and dozens of hours or hundreds of hours of CCTV footage that backs up my experience. And so that was also a factor in mm-hmm. speaking out, because I knew that you don't have to believe what I tell you or listen to the words that come out of my mouth. Just watch the video.
Right.
And I've been very, you know, candid about my accounting of what happened that day and honest.
Mm-hmm.
Same way that I would expect a police officer when they're testifying about their experiences in court. That's how I viewed this. The second theme of that book is, you know, policing and police reform. And again, I try to give an honest accounting of, you know, my experiences as a cop, things that I saw, things that I thought that I may have, you know, mistakes I may have made in my own career.
Mm-hmm.
But all of it is honest and not motivated by anything other than the hopes that it helps, you know, lead us in a more constructive or positive direction in the conversation about both of those topics, January 6th and policing and police reform.
I'm glad you brought that up, because you have a very interesting view on the police reform side. And I think a lot of it may be born out of your own your personal experience in narcotics. You did a Rolling Stone interview and you noted, quote, "We're training officers the same way we did 20 years ago and holding them to a new higher standard. We're setting them up for failure. I'm sorry, dude. I love Jamie Raskin. He's a really nice guy, but he's not designed for what lies ahead, and nor are the other super intellectual types," meaning the people who actually think they know how to do policing or what policing should be doing. They're not getting what's out there on the street. They're not understanding what community policing is versus what it should be versus what we're doing today. How has law enforcement played a role in the underlying narrative related to race and class and all of those elements that you have to encounter and deal with when you're just trying to stop the bad guy from selling drugs, right? For example, and what do you think we need to be looking at to change in how we're training these officers, whether it's in the narcotics division or whether it's in any other division of policing, and how they encounter the public?
Well, I think first, what it comes down to is the most important element of training that you can receive as a police officer really is about how you use force, you know, against members of our community.
Mm-hmm.
Police officers' training in that regard is wholly inadequate. You know, most police officers, my career, you know, I went to the range twice a year. Mm-hmm. I shot at static targets, and that was my, you know, what I would describe as a familiarization with deadly force. We need to be training officers more in line with, you know, what the military has been doing for a number of years. And that's not to say that we want to turn them into, you know,
right,
SEAL Team 6, right, Delta Force, to go out in the community and assassinate everyone. But what we do want is officers who are confident in their tactics, confident in their training. I worked in the training field for a number of years in addition to my law enforcement career. And we would say, you know, confidence, training breeds confidence and proficiency in your weapons and your tactics. And confident officers use less force. If you look at a lot of the newsworthy encounters between law enforcement and members of the public, what I see is a lot of officers who are not well-trained, mm-hmm. who are not confident in their tactics, who are overreacting in situations, or who have not been trained or tested in a way that would place them in a stressful situation and make them make complicated life and death situations. We have the technology to train officers in that way, but policing lacks funding.
Right.
Which is why I'm a proponent of federalizing law enforcement training when it comes to use of force. Police departments vary quite a bit when it comes to their mission. Rural police departments obviously are going to be dramatically different from inner city police departments.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, the way law enforcement uses force against American citizens should be the same across the board, no matter where you are.
You raise an interesting point about the training aspect of this. I hadn't really thought about it in terms of, you go to a range and you're dealing with the static image of a figure, right? And you're doing your shots and you're, getting your, shots within a certain range of each other. And then you're put out there on the street where that figure is not static. And how you react, how you respond in that moment is beyond what you had experienced up to that point, because that figure was just on a screen. It was, 20 yards away and you were shooting at it or whatever. But now you've got something that's moving, that's responding back to you, that's more interactive. And so it's not just testing your proficiency with the weapon, but it's also testing your ability to keep your cool, your ability to assess the situation. As you put it, knowing that there is a limit to where the line is for the use of force and when to employ it. How does that factor in for a lot of particularly new officers now who are pushed out on a street that is very, very different from the one that you saw 20 years ago, your first week on the job, if it will, particularly going into narcotics. The whole narcotics game that we know is much, in some ways it's the same, but in a lot of ways it's different, right? I mean, drugs are still the same, but how they're processing it, where you find it, how they're pushing it, who's using it, who's not, who's selling it, who's buying. It's no longer just the wire kind of storyline where you know what I'm saying? It's a much more sophisticated narrative. So the training has to adapt to that, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, the training has to adapt to it, but also, in a lot of ways, we just need to completely deconstruct as law enforcement, our idea of what training is,
mm-hmm.
Because it's not just the quality of the training that needs to improve. It's the, how often are we training? Two times a year is not, not enough.
Right.
How we train with less than lethal weapons. Somebody asked me the other day about, the officer, I forget her name, who, mistook her service weapon,
right,
for taser for her service weapon,
right,
and said, well, this is a veteran police officer, a well-trained police officer, well-trained in the tactics of deploying a taser. And I was like, well, apparently she was not.
right,
because she mistook her gun for her taser. I'm familiar with the taser training. I know that it's not done in a stressful situation. So there's that, but it's complicated. You have funding issues. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, you actually have to pull these officers off the street and put them through the training. We're in an environment right now where police departments are hemorrhaging officers because no one wants to be a cop.
Right.
And so you don't even have enough officers on the street to be able to pull officers. So then you're having guys train in an overtime status, which costs more money. Officers are more fatigued. And that goes into the second component of police reform, at least for me, mm-hmm. which is officer wellness. And I'm not talking about, you know, handing out stress balls to police officers. I'm talking about dealing with things like career fatigue. That was something that hit me multiple times in my career, mm-hmm. which was I spent 8 to 10 hours of every day, sometimes 6, even 7 days a week, engaging with people who were at their worst moment. And I was doing it all day long. And so it's very easy when you police the same communities every single day to start to take this us against them
right.
approach, to see members of that community as the enemy, to, you know, develop biases, you know, based on those experiences. So how is it that we can interact with officers before they become indifferent to the people that they are serving? You know, when I look at Derek Chauvin and George Floyd, you know, a lot of people jump to the conclusion that, you know, he was racist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. And I don't know if I saw anything in that video that necessarily led me to believe that Derek Chauvin was racist. But I can tell you one thing. He was indifferent to the fact that George Floyd was a human being.
Right.
And his actions certainly reflected that. Is it right? Absolutely not. It's horrid. And, you know, he deserved the punishment that he received. That being said, what are we doing to make sure that officers don't fall into that same pitfall? As far as I know, nothing.
Yeah. And I think I think that analysis is exactly spot on, and is a lot of the frustration that a number of us have with how people are approaching both the community and the police in this very delicate relationship. You know, I just remember growing up in Washington, D.C., we had, you know, a community center. The cops in the neighborhood knew the kids. They knew who the troublemakers were. They knew who the good kids were. There was this level of trust that had been built up. So when you got into a tough encounter, to your very important point, you didn't see that young man in front of you as the enemy. You mm-hmm. saw that young man as the kid that I always, Johnny's doing his thing again. And so let me just get him in a different space. Let me just pull him aside and talk to him and get. So you knew how not to conflate it into a problem, but knew how to de-escalate it to the point where, all right, everybody in respect the corner, you come with me, right? And let's go over here and talk. Very different environment, very different vibe given off by the police, very different vibe received by and returned from the community. And which is why I've always been a strong advocate of community policing, because I saw it work when I was a kid. The cops knew who, you know, the young men in the neighborhood were. They walked that beat. They spent time. They learned the families. They knew, you know, Michael's mom is a single mom. They knew Larry's family was a compact family, mom, dad, you had a little sister, right?
Yeah.
So you knew what those dynamics were. And that's not necessarily an aspect that officers get to learn and experience today as much. Agree or disagree?
I completely agree. And, you know, the reasons behind it are, you know, vast. I mean, you have what I saw first as a police officer coming on the department, you know, in the early 2000s, we still hand wrote our reports. We finally upgraded when I got to the vice office to typewriter.
Right.
I still called my informants on payphones. And, you know, you've seen technology advance at, you know, certainly outpacing me in my career.
Right.
But I started to see as I got older and, you know, assumed a veteran status in my office was younger officers who rely too heavily on technology.
Yep.
Their faces in a computer screen 24/7 while they're out there rather than taking the time to get out and engage with people. I mean, I don't like the moniker community policing.
Right.
It's a turnoff, I think, for a lot of cops. I just call it good police work. I mean, that's your job. Your job is to get out there, to know the community, to understand the dynamics of the community. And, you know, you can call it whatever the hell you want to call it. But that's just, you know, to me, good police work. Now, in defense of those officers who spend their entire day looking in a computer screen, you know, we have so few officers now on the streets that police officers, especially patrol officers, whose job it is to engage with the members of the community and not always in a confrontational manner, they're busy responding from one radio call to the next.
Right.
And, you know, that also goes into, like, as a community, you know, law enforcement is the backbone of our public safety infrastructure. How are we supporting our police departments? How are we making that job a sought after career as it used to be, rather than, you know, something that we attach this stigma to of being, you know, anti-community, anti-black,
right,
anti-whatever, which is not reality.
You make it honest, man. I tell you, that is the part of all of this, is dealing with the reality as the officers are living it and experiences it as the people they are serving are coming into it as well. And a lot of times people just want to throw it up to some sloganeering. They want to just throw it up to something political when the truth is real lives impacted on both sides by how they are trained, how, you know, to work in a community and how that community learns to work with that officer.
Right.
And those officers. And it has not always been perfect, but it has been better. And I think that's that idea of getting back to let's making it work better. And let's doing, as you said, step back, let's review how we're doing this. Let's update our strategies. Certainly let's update our methodology so that we're getting it right.
Yeah.
And people start to trust it.
And politicians need to do a much better job of facilitating constructive conversations between police departments and the communities that they serve. I mean, so often, especially in Washington, D.C., I would go out and speak with members of the community, and their expectations for law enforcement was dramatically different from what, you know, a Charles Allen or some other city council member saying that they wanted from the police department. And so what is going on with that disconnect? Why are our politicians only listening to the people that are screaming into a megaphone and not listening to, you know, members of the community, the majority of the members of that community? And then also, as members of the community, why are we so lazy that we need to be approached before we voice our, you know, thoughts and expectations on what we want, not just for law enforcement, but for a lot of things? I mean, again, this goes back into how we've become lazy in America as to, you know, who's leading us, who are electing to represent us and work on our behalf. You know, we are ultimately our own checks and balances and our own ethics, you know, patrol. Like, we've got to take the vote a hell of a whole lot more serious.
Right. No, dude, that is it right there. You just nailed it. Because at the end of the day, those three most powerful words in all of our founding documents, "We the people," are is where the buck ultimately stops. And so our taking responsibility and holding others accountable and holding ourselves accountable as citizens, I think will begin to help us, as the title of the book says, hold the line. Michael Fanone, thank you so much, brother. I know we went a little bit long. I promised I'd have the brother out a little bit early, but I was enjoying the conversation so much. I really appreciate you, man. I want to thank you for your service, not just on January 6th, but before. As a D.C. resident, I've always had a different appreciation of what the men and women in our city have to do, because all the world comes to our backyard, right? And you got to deal with all of it, and you guys have. So I appreciate that, but I also appreciate you sharing, you know, some of the personal part of your journey as well, and the difficulties that something like January 6th exposes, not just for you, but for all of us, that we have to come to grips with. The book, folks, again, is Hold the Line, The Insurrection and One Cop's Battle for America's Soul. The author is none other than former Metropolitan Police Department officer Michael Fanone. Thank you, bro.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you.
Appreciate you. That does it for this time together, folks. You know, I love it when you come and spend some time listening in on our conversations. Do me the favor, check us out on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher and Spotify. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Follow the podcast at Steele_podcast. Don't forget to do that download thing. You know, I love it when you do it. It makes me feel all yummy inside. So until next time, be safe, be well, take care. God bless.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.